The Sunstone Theological Society presents the Mormon Priesthood Revelation and the Sao Paulo, Brazil Temple, recorded live the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Not sure if this is on. We're glad to welcome you this morning, the last day of this wonderful symposium, and like to express appreciation for coming this morning after staying up late last night hearing that wonderful Pillars of My Faith. And hope you're glad to be here at this session called the Mormon Priesthood Revelation and the Sao Paulo, Brazil Temple. Our speaker today is Mark Grover, who lives in Pleasant Grove, Utah. His education was at Indiana University, receiving his master's in 1979 and his doctorate in 1985. He has had work experience as a research assistant at the Harold B. Lee Library at Brigham Young University, and on the American Historical Review, and his present position is the Latin America Studies Bibliographer at BYU. He has published a number of things: The New Catholic Left in Latin America in 1981, Prelude to Luanda, the Cubans in Africa before 1975, the International Review of History and Political Science in 1985. He has also published in Dialogue in 1984, Religious Accommodation in the Land of Racial Democracy, Mormon Priesthood, and Black Brazilians. Mark Grover has a wife, Deborah, two children, Tony and Sylvia. Comments are written by Ross Peterson. He had to leave this morning to go to speak at a funeral in Idaho. But his paper will be read, and his comments will be given as if he were here, he said. He has a wonderful stand-in friend, Kevin Jones, who is a federal attorney and the editorial associate of the Dialogue publication. You might want to know a little bit about Ross, even though he's physically absent. He's here in his spirit, he says. He received his bachelor's at Utah State University in 1965 and his PhD at Washington State University in 1968. He is a professor of history, and he is the editor of Dialogue. He has also had work experience at the University of Texas and Utah State University. His publications include The Prophet Without Honor with Glenn Taylor and Idaho, A Bicentennial History, and Utah State University, A Century of Service. His wife, Kay, and he have four children, Brett, Julie, Bart, and Matt. He also was on a Fulbright scholarship to New Zealand. So if you can remember all that while the response to Mark Grover's paper, you will see that we have some very, very fine speakers this morning. If there is time after and we have time for questions, will you please make your questions short but speak up plainly and even come up to the mic so that this can be recorded. Thank you.
Thank you. I hope that Dr. Peterson got his notes mixed up and I get the funeral speech and not what he's prepared. Actually, last night I did have a dream, one of those frustrating dreams in which I came and couldn't find the room and realized as I looked at the program that I wasn't even on the program. And then I thought it's 8:30 on Saturday morning and I'm competing with Ogden Kraut. I'm surprised anybody's here. So Thank you for attending. 1978 was a year few members of the Mormon Church in Brazil will forget. The June announcement of the granting of the priesthood to males of African descent eliminated a doctrine that had affected most Brazilians in a very personal way. The São Paulo Temple, in construction since 1975, would be dedicated in November of that year, and the ordinances of the Mormon Temple would become available to local South American members for the first time. It was a year of hard work, excitement, and joy, and as the Brazilians would say, foi carnaval mesmo. The dedication of the temple culminated years of growth and was seen as an indication that the Brazilian church had reached a significant level of spiritual and institutional maturity. The priesthood revelation relieved Brazilians of a difficult historical burden that would allow the church to move into a different and more comfortable future. In order to broaden our understanding of the change in church policy towards blacks, it is necessary to examine the international environment of the church at the time of the revelation. That understanding will of necessity include an examination of the connection between the church in Brazil, the construction of the São Paulo Temple, and the receiving of the priesthood revelation. In so doing, this examination will not be an attempt to establish relationships where none existed, nor will it be an effort to secularize or diminish in any way the important spiritual experience the revelation was to all involved. History has shown that there are several different variables, both secular and religious, involved in understanding changes in church policy and practices. The importance of each and their ultimate effect on decisions are often difficult to determine. Non-believers see the secular environmental factors as the only elements that can be considered in gaining an understanding of an event. The faithful, on the other hand, ignore most influences that are not considered to be part of the religious experience and do not believe non-spiritual factors can be part of the revelation process. Historians who are believers are thus in a dilemma when attempting to examine events such as the priesthood revelation. Since the experience is very personal, the person receiving the revelation often does not recount the details. Even if there are descriptions, they are brief and often do not include a discussion of the process that led up to the revelation. We are then left with spotty details and little source material to work with. Consequently, historians, almost out of necessity, are required to focus on the secular elements. This study is written with the realization of those limitations and difficulties in mind. It is expected understanding and appreciation of the activities occurring in Brazil will be seen as only part of the picture and not the whole. The study will also emphasize that Mormonism is an international church and that events occurring outside of Utah in the United States have in the past and will continue in the future play an important role in the evolution, development, and growth of the church as a whole. Few non-African countries have been more influenced by Africa than has Brazil. Slavery was legal until 1888, and between 1550 and 1850, over 3 million African slaves were brought to Brazil to provide a workforce for the country's plantations and mines. The scarcity of European women during the colonial period encouraged miscegenation and resulted in the development of a society with a very small white minority and a majority that was black, mulatto, and mestizo. Important European and Asian migrations between 1884 and 1957 altered the racial picture in some areas of Brazil, but did not diminish the importance of the black and mixed population. The sheer size of the black population significantly affected Brazilians' attitudes towards race. Interracial marriage was and is an acceptable and common practice within most classes of Brazilian society. Estimates indicate that over 50% of the population is either black or some combination of black, white, or Indian. The presence of a large mixed population has encouraged the development of a society in which any form of racial segregation is illegal. And racial prejudice, though not eliminated, is less of a social factor than in most other countries of the world. Mormon missionaries first came to Brazil in 1928 to proselyte recent European immigrants. Small German colonies in southern Brazil attracted Mormon missionaries from Argentina, who believed they could teach Germans while at the same time avoiding the surrounding Brazilian population. Once established in Brazil, however, they did not leave, even though a 1938 government policy restricted their work with the German immigrants, and the focus of missionary work had to turn towards the Portuguese-speaking population. The church remained in the south, where the largest number of European immigrants lived and was the region that was least affected by miscegenation. Once the missionaries began teaching Brazilians, two racial issues surfaced. First, contact with persons of African descent was unavoidable in almost any part of the country. The illegality of segregated housing meant that there were neither official nor unofficial residential areas for blacks, as had occurred in South Africa or parts of the United States. Consequently, missionaries could not work in any area without inadvertently contacting blacks or their descendants. This was generally not a problem with contacts who had obvious African physical features, but was serious for investigators who looked European but had distant black ancestors. Second, differences in perceptions between the American missionaries and Brazilian members concerning the identification of blacks often resulted in conflict. That difference basically is that Brazilians saw a black person in terms of their physical features, whereas Americans generally saw it as genetic or genealogical. Members who believed in the church and followed the policy on priesthood restrictions would interest family and friend in the church only to discover that the missionaries believed them to have African ancestry. Strict guidelines were established to avoid many problems, and methods were developed that limited as much as possible the inevitable conflict. By the 1960s, an uneasy but workable system was in place that, though not always appreciated by the members, was acceptable and functioned to ensure that church policy was followed. Most Brazilian members were uncomfortable with the church's policy. Their association with an American-based church with a policy that denied spiritual and institutional rights to blacks led friends and relatives to accuse them of racism, a label difficult for a Brazilian to live with. At the same time, they did not feel they had a right or even the possibility to question or work towards a change in the policy. The policy was a revelation from God, and it can only be changed when a new revelation was received through the proper religious channels. The traditional patrimonial, political, and social system that functioned in the country encouraged Brazilians to accept what was done by higher authorities, and even though not in agreement, learn to live with the policy. The situation remained essentially the same until the announcement of the construction of the São Paulo Temple in 1975. The construction of the temple was a landmark event in the history of the church in Brazil, and consequently created an environment in which change might be contemplated. In order to understand this relationship between the church, the Brazilian church, the São Paulo Temple, and the priesthood revelation, it's important for us to examine two areas. First, experiences with blacks by President Kimball and other general authorities, and second, the events that occurred during the later stages of the construction of the temple. Only one general authority came to Brazil in an official capacity prior to the 1954 visit of President McKay. After this initial visit, however, visits by members of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles and other general authorities were fairly regular, especially following the 1966 organization of the first stake in São Paulo. Almost without exception, members of the church's hierarchy were confronted with questions and problems dealing with race. President McKay was asked by a young priesthood holder whether he should marry a young woman of African descent. During his tour of the Brazilian mission in 1961, Joseph Fielding Smith was questioned regularly by members and missionaries concerning the priesthood restrictions. Gordon B. Hinckley, after meeting an active Brazilian family of African descent, reportedly became concerned with the policy in general and received an understanding of the reasons for its restrictions. It was Spencer W. Kimball, however, who had more such experiences while in Brazil. President Kimball's numerous experiences were due primarily to the fact that beginning in 1959, he visited Brazil regularly as its ecclesiastical administrator and or as a missionary or a state conference visitor. He worked to get the São Paulo Temple ready for organization in 1966 and persuaded some hesitant colleagues in the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles of the need for its organization. He maintained an interest and concern for the Brazilian members of the church while serving as the president of the Quorum of the Twelve and as a prophet. He was by far the most well-known and beloved church administrator in Brazil. His experiences with black members in the church began with his first 1959 visit. That time, Apostle Kimball was confronted by a young black member who questioned whether there was any useful way that he could serve in the church. President Kimball wrote, quote, "My heart wanted to burst for him. I think I helped him with tithing and drink, and I think he went away less perturbed and more sure of himself," end quote. Kimball's frequent visits to South America over the next 20 years and his close friendship with Brazilian members made him sensitive to the Brazilian problem. He counseled mission presidents and stake leaders concerning the ramifications of the priesthood restrictions. During his visits to Brazil, he would meet with black members and talk to them about their need for continued faithfulness to the church. His experiences in Brazil served as a constant reminder, not necessarily of the doctrinal aspects of the priesthood denial, but the administrative, personal, and often tragic results of this policy. One interesting relationship Kimball had was with Elvésio Martins, a black member in Rio de Janeiro. Elvésio and his family joined the church in the early 1970s, becoming extremely active in the local ward and stake. Unlike most blacks who became Mormons in Brazil, the Martins family was neither poor nor uneducated. Elvésio held an advanced degree in economics and worked as a high-level accounting administrator for Petrobras, a publicly owned oil company and the largest corporation in Brazil. He also taught economics at one of Brazil's major universities and maintained prominent social status in the financial community. In fact, in terms of social prominence, the Martins family probably had more status than any other Mormon in Brazil. The Martins family presented an interesting dilemma for church leadership. They accepted completely the church's doctrines, including the restrictions on their own activities. They became a model Mormon family, attending all church functions and doing all they were asked to do, seemingly without reservations. Consequently, the church was restricting participation not of a poor or uneducated black, but a family whose education, prestige, administrative ability, and financial standing was higher than most other members of the church. The family had in turn reacted to the restrictions with a level of faith and devotion few members can claim. The Martins family soon became well known throughout the church in Brazil for their dedication to the church. Martins also became prominent in the church for other reasons. Elvésio was put in charge of public relations for the church in Rio de Janeiro and became the spokesman for the church in the second largest population center of the church of the country. Important Brazilian television stations and newspapers were in Rio, and consequently, Elvésio Martins became the church's most visible spokesman. In this position, he gave interviews to the press, explaining doctrines and activities, brought dignitaries to visit the church, and worked to advertise Mormonism throughout the country. Church leaders in Brazil made sure that American general authorities visiting the country met and talked with Martins. Elvésio visited several times with President Kimball, including a two-hour interview in Salt Lake City after a general conference. President Kimball took special interest in the Martins family, meeting with them on most of his visits and making sure that they had an understanding of what was expected. The Martins became not only the church's answer to outside critics, but unknowingly became the Brazilian advocate to leaders for the need for change in the racial policy of the church. A pivotal event in the history of the church in Brazil came with the announcement of the construction of the São Paulo Temple in March of 1975. Unlike other Mormon buildings, male members had to hold the priesthood to be judged worthy to even enter the temple. The building of the temple brought to the forefront the issue of the priesthood restriction. Some observers have suggested that officials became concerned with the difficulty the church would have keeping members with African ancestry out of the temple because of the problems of racial identification. This did appear to be a concern to some. However, the major issue the construction of the Brazilian temple presented does not appear to be administrative. The Brazilian church already had a method for racial identification to determine worthiness for the priesthood that would only have to be extended to determine those allowed to enter the temple. The role of the construction of the São Paulo Temple in the church's priesthood policy change probably had more to do with compassion than with administrative concerns. How to allow blacks into the temple and not how to keep them out probably became the concern of the prophet. Several incidences during the last phases of the construction of the temple show that President Kimball and other general authorities were concerned and interested in the priesthood issue. Several black members helped with certain tasks in the construction of the temple, and the prophet was kept informed of those activities by authorities in Brazil. James E. Faust, the area supervisor for Brazil at the time, stated in 1977 that black members helped, quote, to make blocks for the temple just as everybody else. They have made their monetary contributions for the construction of the temple, and they've made their sacrifices just as everybody else. And I've advised President Kimball and Brother McConkie of the faithfulness of these people. Brother McConkie at that time was the member in the Council of the Twelve that had administrative responsibility for Brazil. Gordon B. Hinckley, in a talk given at the dedication of the temple, indicated that he knew of the sacrifices and contributions of black members and was touched that they were willing to work on the temple. Other general authorities were also aware, as seen in this comment that is attributed to Apostle LeGrand Richards. Quote, all those people with Negro blood in them have been raising the money to build the temple. With this situation that we feel down in Brazil, Brother Kimball worried a lot about it, how the people are so faithful and devoted, end quote. Activities of the Martins family were also noted. Elvesi was asked to serve on the Temple Dedication Public Relations Committee, coordinating information for media exposure. Consequently, he was at the cornerstone laying ceremony in March of 1977, in which several general authorities were present, including the prophet. Prior to the start of the ceremony, President Kimball saw Martins in the audience and asked him to come to the podium. He sat him down and gave him this counsel, quote, and this is from Brother Martins' words, Brother, what is necessary for you is faithfulness. Remain faithful and you will enjoy all the blessings of the church, end quote. Martins returned to his seat, not understanding the reason for the counsel and preoccupied with the experience. That preoccupation significantly increased when a few months later, James E. Faust, in Rio for church meetings, requested that Martins accompany him to the airport. He asked Martins if he remembered the words of President Kimball. He stated that all members of the church should heed the counsel, but it was especially important for Martins to remain faithful and keep the commandments. He then gave further explanation of the importance of remaining faithful and keeping the commandments. Faust did not give him any special reason for his additional advice. Martins remained concerned over these unusual experiences with the prophet and with Elder Faust. Brother Martins continued to work with the publicity committee, making several trips to São Paulo to attend meetings with members of the full committee. During one such visit, he and his wife walked onto the partially constructed main floor of the temple. He described what happened. I went onto the temple construction with my wife, walking among the construction metals and woods, and stopped at a certain place. We felt an unusually strong spirit at that time. We held each other and cried for some time. We realized later we were standing in the exact spot of the celestial room of the temple. We felt a strong, indescribable feeling in that place. Impressive. Extraordinarily strong. It was one of the most spiritual experiences of our lives. They had no idea, end quote, they had no idea what the experience meant. Others observing the scene placed their own interpretation on what had happened and spread the word throughout the country. This experience, as I've allowed a number of Brazilians to read this after I wrote it, and every one of them point to this experience as probably one of the most important experiences during this year. Several people were at the meetings of these committees that just got out, and several people were standing around the temple watching what was happening. And I'm told, although I haven't been able to confirm it, that actually Elder Faust was there at the time and actually saw this happen. And in many ways, this story has achieved the status of folktale, as everybody that I've talked to knew that this happened and felt it had something to do with the change that was to occur months later. An emotional type of an influence. Martins was again surprised in March of 1978 with a change in policy on home teaching. His stake president received a call from William Grant Bangeter, the General Authority Area Administrator for Brazil, advising him of a change in the policy that allowed worthy black men to act in the formerly restricted priesthood function of serving as a junior companion home teacher. Though this appears to be a very simple change, it was very significant to Martins. Notice his comment, quote, well, this worried us even more. I remember in our family home evening that night, we decided something was about to happen. We didn't know what. We did not think of anything related to the priesthood. We had conditioned ourselves to believe the granting of the priesthood to blacks would occur only in the millennium, but we felt something special was about to happen. We didn't know what it was, but we felt we should get ready. Within 3 months of that experience, the priesthood revelation was announced. As with most members of the church, the announcement was a joyous shock to the Brazilians. Many had hoped that something would happen so that faithful black members could attend the dedication ceremonies and participate fully in the events of the temple opening, but few expected such a major change. When the revelation was made public, Bruce R. McConkie called the area administrator, William Grant Bangeter, with the news. Elder Bangeter stated, quote, "I was overwhelmed with the implications of what actually happened. How could I imagine that this moment had really come?" End quote. He immediately called a meeting of mission and stake presidents in the area and read the letter of the First Presidency. One president present explained what happened. Quote, "It was a very emotional day for all of us. Most cried at that occasion. One man, I believed, who could not cry, even he had tears in his eyes when Elder Bangeter read President Kimball's announcement. It was very emotional." End quote. Word of the revelation spread rapidly among the members. Official reading of the revelation occurred the following Sunday. Elder Bangeter described their reactions. Quote, "I was present on a few occasions when the announcement was made in priesthood meetings or in public meetings. People didn't respond as they would in the spirit of the 4th of July or something like that, with excitement and tears, but their emotions were very deep. I think their response would be characterized by heaving great sighs of emotion and raising their eyes to heaven in the spirit of thanksgiving and prayer, and tears flowing freely from their eyes and just quietly trying to absorb the meaning of all that had taken place." End quote. The relationship between the revelation and Brazil was emphasized in the dedication of the São Paulo Temple 5 months later. All worthy members of the church, including blacks, were allowed to attend the ceremonies held in the celestial room with an overflow audience in the chapel of a nearby stake center. It was in one of the last dedication ceremonies that the relationship between the two events was noted, as reported by a member in attendance. Elder Gordon B. Hinckley was conducting. During the dedication prayer by President Kimball, Hinckley thought of the revelation and noted that throughout the session, blacks had been in attendance. As the prayer finished, he was in tears and noticed that a black family in attendance was also in tears. He then spoke to the congregation concerning his feelings and described an experience in Brazil where he had received an understanding of why the priesthood restrictions had occurred. He also described how the First Presidency had been aware of the significant financial and time contributions of black members towards the construction of the temple. He believed that their contributions to a building they would not be allowed to enter was the greatest test that these members would ever have to endure. During a subsequent session, President Kimball continued on the same theme. He explained how he had gone several times to a special room in the Salt Lake Temple, explaining in prayer to the Lord that this doctrine had been one that he had defended and was willing to continue to defend. He stated that he understood it, had supported it, and that the leaders of the church were willing to continue to support it if required to do so. After explaining this, he said, if there was any way at this time that the destiny of this people in the church could be changed. He explained that it was at this point in one of his prayers that the revelation came to him. Conclusion. The actual role of the above described events in the priesthood revelation will probably never be known. However, I would like to make the following suggestions. Number one, Brazil since 1940 had represented to the general authorities the internal, institutional, and personal ramifications and results of the priesthood restrictions throughout the church. Presented the church for the first time with the dilemma of restricting on a large scale entrance into a temple to those who were worthy. Many of those who would not be allowed to enter the temple had responded to the temple construction with financial contributions and labor on the temple itself. And number five, Elvésio Martins became a symbol of a faithful member with tremendous leadership potential who was unable to fully participate in the blessings of the church. In the 10 years since the revelation, much has happened in Brazil. Without the priesthood restrictions, the church has expanded throughout the country. The growth has been most notable in the Northeast as small branches became stakes within a couple of years. Five missions now administer the northern area where one existed in 1978. Congregations now mirror the demographic makeup of the regions where they exist. There are blacks in all executive positions of the church. They are bishops, stake presidents, and regional representatives. Black male and female missionaries are serving in Brazil and Portugal. Elvésio Martins and his wife are presently presiding over the Brazil Fortaleza mission. The priesthood restrictions of 10 years ago are a fading memory for members of the church. Since more than half the members have been baptized after 1978, many are not even aware that there were such restrictions. For those that do, 1978 will be remembered as a year of important change. Thank you. Many people who attend Sunstone symposiums dream of participating themselves as major speakers and developing perhaps an aurora about themselves like a Linda Silto or Alan Roberts or my good friend Linda Newell. Indeed, you may even dream of being mentioned in one of Don Tracy's muckraking articles in the Tribune. Now, like you, as a participant at the Sunstone symposiums, and a government lawyer laboring in an obscure federal Department of the Interior, responsible for such obscure things such as Indian law and labor law and water law, I too dream of being spotlighted at a Sunstone symposium. Somehow, however, I thought that my first presentation would at least be one that I had written. Today I find myself, however, filling in for a good friend's shoes, Mr. Ross Peterson, who first thrust this paper into my hands at 8:15 this morning and told me that he was going to attend a funeral in Idaho. Well, he's gone to a funeral, and I told him after, you may need to return quickly for my own. So both you and members of this audience are on a slight journey together. It will literally be the first time that I have read it and the first time I'm sure that you will have received it, but nevertheless, it'll be worth your while. In the 10-plus years since the Mormon priesthood revelation, historians and other scholars, as well as lay members, have wondered why the year 1978. Many have postulated that concerns over third world problems for the church because of racial restrictions led to the revelation. Others have talked about West African potential for Mormonism. Few have speculated that black North Americans pressured for full equality. Through all of these educated guesses and less than profound speculations, a number of individuals have discussed the importance of Brazil, and in particular the significance of building a temple in São Paulo. As you have heard, Mark Grover has done an excellent job in assisting us to understand the Brazilian role in that decision, but also documented the importance of black Mormons in Brazil. His essay does not diminish the significance of black Mormons in Utah, Africa, Central America, or anywhere else in the world. His paper provides a major contribution in spite of the limits that he describes and has placed upon it. Let me quickly reread the two paragraphs of his paper that illustrate the dilemma faced by historians while trying to study the decision-making process in an institution like the LDS Church, and I quote, "History has shown that there are generally several different variables, both secular and religious, involved in understanding changes in church policy and practices. The importance of each and their ultimate effect on decisions are difficult to determine. Non-believers see the secular, the environmental factors, as the only elements that can be considered in gaining an understanding of an event. The faithful in general ignore most influences that are not considered to be part of their own particular religious experience and do not believe non-spiritual factors can be part of the revelation process. Historians who are believers are thus placed in a dilemma when attempting to examine events such as the priesthood revelation. Since the experience is very personal, the person receiving the revelation often does not recount the details. Even if there are descriptions, they are brief and often do not include a description of the process leading up to the revelation itself. Historians are left with spotty details and little primary source material to work with. Consequently, they almost always out of necessity are required to focus on the secular elements." End of the quote. What Mark, I think, is kindly saying is that contemporary students of Mormon history are denied access to the full scope of how ill-conceived and embarrassing evolutionary racial policy was changed by revelation. Since First Presidency minutes and quorum of the 12 minutes are not available, since personal journals of church leaders are not utilized as open historical documents, the researcher is limited to gathering second-hand information. Children of apostles, members of the Quorum of the 70, family friends, and others are utilized by Grover and other scholars. Were there discussions or debates on the policy? Did associates realize that Spencer W. Kimball was so moved by injustice and prejudice as to ask the fundamental question, why? Did anyone really and vocally resist? Were some leaders, perhaps James Fount and Grant Bangeter, used to educate those who may have resisted? For a church to base its existence on revelation and sending tens of thousands of young and old people into the world telling the Joseph Smith story, to deny full access to continuing revelation is a mystery. I'm reminded of my own research, Ross's research, into the background of the 1954 Supreme Court decision, Brown versus the Board of Education in Topeka. This was not a revelation, but had a national impact not unlike the internal church impact of the 1978 revelation. The court privately discussed, analyzed, and debated among themselves for 3 years prior to the decision on integration. Presidents tried to dissuade them. Attorney generals attempted to delay them. Each new appointee was carefully and completely politicalized for his views on these issues. Finally, a plan was developed, and the key was unanimity. So Justices Frankfurter, Douglas, and Warren Burger spent a winter persuading former Klan member, black and racist Justice Clark, that the decision must be 9-0 and that there could not be any dissent on a decision of such national monumental importance. Of course, all the records are available. The memorandums, diaries, letters, meeting notes are all there for any historian to examine. This analogy is really an intellectual pipe dream, but the church bases much of its proselyting efforts on Joseph Smith's own story of his first vision. Some of the background and the detail of the priesthood revelation would assist in the convincing that, quote, God will yet reveal many great and important things, end quote. Consequently, there are many unanswered inquiries about the priesthood revelation. However, Mark Grover has done an excellent job in explaining how Brazil played an undeniably important and significant role in the priesthood revelation. Utilizing oral histories from Brazil, as well as Salt Lake City, Utah, he has detailed why Brazil's racial democratic policies made missionary work and leadership development difficult. A discriminatory organization was viewed as regressive in a society attempting to reach social democracy and justice. The LDS Church suffered the same public relations difficulties in North America. The essay documents, once again, the great power of black individual church members. Those who remained active and involved played a great role in educating visiting general authorities on faithfulness. The Martins family are a great example of individual commitment. A very important question relative to this essay concerns the history of genealogical research in Brazil and how that related to temple work. It is true that certain priesthood holders who found black progenitors were forced to revoke the priesthood. If true, what impact does the well-described racial reality have on genealogy and temple building? Does the research indicate that members in Brazil were anxious for such a revelation and change? How important are international cultural differences within the church? Were North American missionaries sensitized by their Brazilian experience? The net impact of the relation in Brazil is magnificent. It heralds a new day for the LDS Church and has moved the organization to a higher level of humanity and social justice. Unfortunately, the saints will constantly have to wonder what might have been if the decision to extend the priesthood was made earlier. Unfortunately, it was the white saints in America, in Brazil, and elsewhere, rather than the black, who really needed to prepare for that event. Mark Grover has added immensely to the scholarship in Brazil. There's much to be done in West and South Africa and the Caribbean. It is a task worthy of the effort. I'd like to just say two quick things on my own. as I've noticed listening to both papers for the first time. As a lawyer and sometimes student of the Supreme Court, I understand the Brown decision very well. It was an extremely important decision where unanimity amongst the justices was a goal and was achieved. One criticism I would have of Mr. Ross's paper is, while former Justice Tom Clark, whose son is probably better known than he is, Ramsey, was from the Deep South and did hold some of those views, I would not have necessarily characterized him as a racist. Perhaps a little slow in accepting certain social changes, but most members who study the Supreme Court would not have characterized him in such strong language. In terms of Mr. Grover's paper, one of the things that I was struck with personally that was most interesting is the effect that apparently the individual members in Brazil had on the general authorities, particularly President Kimball. When that personal identification is made, it's always much harder to say no to somebody, I found. And as a federal bureaucrat, I always know when the person comes in and sees me and I put a face with their request, it then is much harder. So I have no doubt that considering the fine person who President Kimball was, which this these remarks tends to even make me hold him in higher esteem, that had to play a different role. It also brought to mind my young childhood days when I was raised in the Foreign Service and lived in various developing countries. We used to get visiting dignitaries from the Washington offices. They would travel around somewhat like a circus, and we used to make fun of them at first for their little traveling shows of how much they could learn in 1 or 2 days. But we found if we could get them there, get them to visit with the local people and spend a little time, their perception of international events gradually changed. And perhaps this happened as well. Well, thank you for your patience. I hope that Ross Peterson's still my friend after his presentation. I'm sorry I can't answer any of his questions for you.
We have time for questions. I was just wondering if Mr. Grover wanted to respond to
more of a comment than a question. Mark, did you serve a mission in Brazil?
Yes, I did.
Mark did serve a mission in Brazil. Have to get it recorded.
In the beginning, I was one of the pioneers in 55.
Would you like to come to the microphone and explain that?
I was a missionary in Brazil from 55 to 58, and I have very strong roots with Brazil. I have 100 Brazilians in my home every conference Sunday after General Church Conference, and I return to Brazil every 2 years to visit with these friends to renew long-time relationships. My mission president was responsible for picking out the ground for the São Paulo Temple, Azel T. Sorensen. He told me the story that he was flying with Brother Lee across South America. At that time, he was in charge of real estate for South America. And Brother Lee leaned over to him and says, President Sorensen, if we were to put a temple in South America, where would you suggest that it go? We need it in a place that if there was a revolution, we could convert it to a chapel. Brother Lee wasn't familiar with all of South America because they don't do those things everywhere, at least not in Brazil. And, of course, my mission president being very prejudiced and thinking the only place in the world, the only mission in the world, the greatest place in the world was Brazil. And he says, well, Brother Lee, the logical place is São Paulo. It's the center of South America. He says, you find a piece of ground and we'll look at it. So my mission president found that piece of ground. And then I think Brother Lee had passed away and Brother Kimball approved of it. President Sorensen said when he stood on the ground, he had a feeling like he'd never had before. And he felt within his being that was the logical place for the temple. Something I'd like to bring out to you that I think we should be aware of. In Brazil, as I, being a missionary, 20% of the mission was black. And you know, you would think that American missionaries going to a country in those days where their few missionaries went to black areas, that there would be prejudice. And you know, I came from a family of parents who were prejudiced. They weren't highly educated. They made derogatory remarks about all races. But you know, in Brazil, I never saw any missionary ever mistreat or ever feel any differently towards our black members than any of the other members. We loved, we hugged, we kissed, we embraced our black brothers and sisters just as much as we did any of the other members. To us, there was no such thing as color. They were just members of God's kingdom, and we loved each and every one of them the same. And I think that's remarkable. I remember once seeing a missionary come from the South who, with his Southern accent, I thought, oh boy, we're going to have trouble. He'll never learn to love these people because he's come from a prejudiced area. You know, that was not the case. I watched him over that 2.5 years. He loved the people just as much as we did. And I think we should be aware of that. I think that's something in favor of the church, that somehow missionaries behave in a different manner. Prejudices don't exist, and it never existed in Brazil among us. We felt brokenhearted that these good brethren could not have the priesthood, but we trusted in the Lord and thought someday he'll make it right with them, and he has. One final thing. May I tell you a very inspirational experience with President Benson over this revelation? My barber is President Benson's barber. And
this hearsay is all true.
Yes. And many other general authorities, and I continued with him as my barber for that purpose for many years, because I always got the latest weekly inspirational story. Anyway, I said, Roger, this was a month or so later, did you ever ask any of the brethren about that experience in the temple over the revelation? And he says, Gary, that's interesting that you should ask that. He says, you know, Brother Benson was in last week. And I said, what really happened in the temple? And he was cutting his hair, and he said, just a minute, Roger. And he turned around in the chair. He says, Roger, let me tell you something. I have been an apostle for so many years. I've dedicated chapels, state houses. I've spoken in general conference, in state conferences. I've seen inspiration through meetings, through experiences in all my life. I felt the presence of the Lord many times. But he says, Roger, that was the most spiritual experience of my life. He says, I thought that in that room, I could reach out and touch the Savior, because there was something emanating from the room covering all of us like we had never felt before. The Spirit of the Lord was so powerful that all I can tell you, Roger, is that was the greatest spiritual experience of my life. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Gary Kay from Salt Lake City. Any other questions or comments? Any other returned missionaries?
I'd like to ask Gary, what year was that? You could remember that date.
The question was about the date that President Lee was in South America, and it isn't known right now for sure. Yes.
My name is Lynn Hilton. I used to be president of the Egypt and Sudan district of the church. And I remember when I was set apart by Grant Bangeter, he said, now, Brother Hilton, make sure that you don't ordain any Negroes in the Sudan and in Egypt, because we had the same problem you have in Brazil. We have mixed races there. And we have indigenous members in Egypt in particular. And some of our members, of course, were of mixed parentage. So I said, well, President Bangeter, how do you distinguish between who should receive the priesthood and who should not? Well, he said, down in Brazil, he said, you know, Brother Bangeter used to be a president of one of the missions down there. He said, we would ask to see the family photo album. And if we would see any Negro characteristics in the faces of grandmother or grandfather or so on, he said, we would not ordain them. He says, no, I give you that advice. And I was serving in Egypt at the time of this announcement of priesthood. And I just want to make this comment that, first of all, I didn't believe it. It took weeks before it was reconfirmed. When it came out in the newspaper, it was such good news, I couldn't believe it. But when it was reconfirmed, and we actually had official letters of instruction on how to proceed in Egypt, I'll tell you this very honestly. I was so relieved and so grateful that I never had to preach that priesthood sermon again. That was a very difficult thing for me to explain the church's stand on priesthood. But we faithfully carried out the church policy up until it was changed. And let me say this before I sit down. You know, President Kimball one time said that indigenous Egyptians, he was talking about the youth of Egypt, he said, the day will come that young Egyptians will have Mormon youth conferences They will climb the pyramids and go down into the tombs of the pharaohs, he said, and they will serve missions. I can now see how that can happen. But at the time, I couldn't. I couldn't understand how that could be fulfilled. And I detected a contradiction between the church's desire to expand the missionary work to every nation and the restriction on priesthood. But now it's quite all obvious, and the road ahead of us is quite clear.
Thank you so much. Any other comments or questions? Sharing? Yes.
My name is Louisa Greaves, and my father was the first temple president of the São Paulo Temple Mission. He was on a temple mission, and he was there at the time that the announcement was made. And just in reading his letters, I could just see the great joy and relief that came to him when that announcement was made. He had previously been a mission president there in Brazil and grew to love the Brazilians, black and white and of all races. And it was such a relief to them because they knew so many people that were held back because of this church policy. And for them, it was a day of great joy and a great spiritual experience for them, too, when this announcement was made. And I just remember in their letters how the relief that they had, because it caused such a problem there, but they knew and could feel that revelation came from the Lord, and they were just grateful to be there and to be a part of it at that time.
Thank you so much. Any other comments or questions?
My brother... can you hear me? My brother was on a mission in São Paulo area before World War II. Now that was rather early time, and there was much German agitation and so forth there. When he finally came back and went in the service and has died, when I went to Brazil, it was really a tremendous thing for me to go to that. It's quite a small temple. It's like almost like a meeting house, and it was really a big thrill for me to go there and to think that Spencer had a great deal or had something to do with building the temple there.
Get your name, Ruth?
Ruth Crownover. I'm from San Francisco.
Thank you. Someone else would like to share observations or ask questions?
I was a missionary in Brazil, aged 68 and 69. Jerry Fisher, in the South Mission. There weren't too many, I don't suppose there's many blacks in that area, but it was hard for us not to want to teach those people who were so eager to teach, who wanted to know the gospel, or at least to seem to be as friendly and as interested in Americans as somebody else. Well, we learned to, in our own makeshift way, distinguish between who might want us, who we should teach and who we shouldn't. But when we heard about the revelation, we were so... I personally thought of all the people I knew that were faithful and some of the best leaders we had in the church who had either received the priesthood and couldn't use it any longer or knew that they probably would. Most people that I talked to never thought there would even be a temple in Brazil because of their idea of the laws there, that there could be no private building. Everything had to be made public. And most of them never even imagined that the blacks would have the priesthood. I'm not sure what you discussed before, but I'm personally confident that the primary thrust for the change in the policy had to do with that area of the world. There was so much, it's resolved so many problems, and who was going to be endowed and who wasn't, that I'm sure that had to be one of the major reasons President Kimball struggled with that. He had just been the area president, the general authority over South America just before I got there. And so I'm sure he was acutely aware of some of the situations.
Well, thank you so much. Yes?
I'd like to ask
the question has to do with the influence of the Brazilian-Portuguese combination and how that has been influenced in the church. Mark Grover will respond to that question.
The church in Portugal began in 1975. William Graham Banger was its president. All four first missionaries were transferred from the Brazilian mission. Two of them were native missionaries. And the policy since that time has been that half of the missionaries in Portugal would either be Brazilian or Portuguese. In examining the two churches, it's incredible the difference that has between Portugal and Brazil. Portugal had a stake within 8 years. Brazil had a stake in 1966, and the church entered in 1928. There are many reasons for that tremendous growth in Portugal, but much of it has to do with the fact that you already had missionaries, Portuguese-speaking missionaries. You had literature, you had a program, you had members that could come over and be missionaries and teach and that type of thing. So it's had a tremendous effect. However, Portugal at this time now is growing and expanding to a point that they're supplying many of their own missionaries, so that the number of Brazilian missionaries serving in Portugal has diminished quite a bit. However, mission presidents are still former Brazilian mission presidents.
There's a large black contingent that.
In Portugal, Portugal is a very traditionally Catholic country, and so that the growth in Portugal has occurred primarily with African immigrants. First, they were white African immigrants that came when the colonies, Angola and Mozambique, were given their independence, and there were about 1 million that returned to Portugal. The majority of the members were from that group, and at the present time now, the majority of the members who are being baptized are black African migrants, primarily economic migrants from Cape Verde and Angola and Guinea-Bissau. So the church in Portugal now, in terms of just looking at it, it's about 25. If you look at the ward, about 25% of the members in Portugal are African blacks.
Well, thank you. Hasn't this been a very special hour? And appreciate all of you participating. And let's give our speakers another hand and enjoy the rest of your day.